And may I say how helpful I found that resume of who cares for the carers. It would certainly tally very much with my own experience of having to treat doctors, ministers and missionaries and their wives or husbands over the years. And I think I would also reiterate the comment which he made about the person who has very strong evangelical, biblical views, sometimes using that almost as a defense against looking at themselves and the way in which their lives may be impinging upon other people. I used to say in my moments of frustration when I was a younger psychiatrist, and again it used to disturb some of the people who knew me, when I used to say it, my worst patients are my Christian patients. And by that I meant that it often took two or three sessions to work through all the garbage of the spiritual material before you could get to the really gutsy material of their hates, their resentments, their losses, their feelings of desperation, which were all put into theological terms, spiritual terms, and so on. I think that's less now than it used to be 20 years ago. That would be my feeling now, but it's still there. I think one of the things that one has seen in society is that people are more prepared to look at the weaknesses within themselves, except that there's a new wave now of, well, we know the answer to everything, don't we? And a certain types of spiritual experience being purveyed as the answer to everything maybe is coming up on the flank to get us back into a situation which I thought we were getting out of. Well, let's look at some case studies, as it were, and more practical approaches. I mean, I was very theoretical in my approach. I was trying to give an overview of a way to look at all this. So let's see if we can pick up some more practical issues. And let me begin with marriage. I was given a topic. I was given a list of things I had to cover, by the way. So let's look at marriage. And I thought I'd quote from some work and some papers some time ago, which actually says marriage actually damages health and should have, you know, when you publish the marriage bans, you should say, and by the way, there's a health hazard warning attached to this for women. Because marriage is good for the health of men and bad for the health of women. Marriage protects men from morbidity. Married men don't go nearly so often to the general practitioners or to psychiatrists. They have half the rate of attendance compared with single men. But marriage afflicts women. The married woman has a far higher incidence of mental illness than her single sister, four times as high. Single men do consistently worse than single women. So there is a very real health hazard attached to marriage for women. So let's just begin with that. Why should this be? Well, there is no doubt that if you have children, that puts you into a very special category as well. A woman who's had a baby, I think the incidence is there is a 12 times greater incidence of having a severe depression following the birth of the baby compared with a woman of the same age, married or single, who hasn't had a baby. So you know, you immediately put yourself into a very morbid category of individuals. A lot of work has demonstrated in the past that the woman with three children or so, under the age of five, social class five, not having a job herself, married to a rather uncommunicative man, is almost certain to be depressed by definition. And in many parts of our cities and so on, there's a very high proportion of women in just those categories. So, you know, marriage, you know, all the gloss and the tinsel and all the rest of it, all one can say about it is that there's an enormous amount of morbidity and distress. And I think many of the people who are referred to me have a marriage problem somewhere in the agenda, or in the baggage, as it's said. That's absolutely right. And I wonder how often one sees this. And I want to take three case histories to outline the sort of issues which sometimes lie behind this. One lady was a lady who had a severe depression. She was in her late 30s. She was a professional lady, highly skilled, who very much appreciated her job. This was an extremely important thing for her. She had a family. The family were getting on a bit, and she coped with the children very well, by and large. But she had a chronic and consistent depression, which from time to time got much worse. So when I saw her, there was a strong family history of depression. There was a history of an extremely violent, physically violent and emotionally violent mother, who herself was probably mentally ill, but had not been picked up. So here was the background, and she undoubtedly required an antidepressant. She was put in an antidepressant and showed quite dramatic improvement. She was on a kind of antidepressant which probably, if you go on it, you have to be on it for a very long period of time. She couldn't eat cheese and various other things like this. But there is no doubt that transformed her life, so that whereas before she hadn't been coping with her job, she began to cope with her job much more consistently and said that while she was at work, she felt great. Thank you very much, doctor. I really feel I can cope with my life. But when I go home, I don't know what it is, I just feel everything overwhelms me, I burst into tears, and I get these almost suicidal panics. And at weekends, it's worse. Well, that's a good indication that you need to see the spouse as well. And so I asked the husband to come along. I'd seen him before, but that was really just to get a feel of what the depression was like and so on. So back he came, and he's a nice chap, and he came, and very compliant in terms of being cooperative and obviously cared for his wife. They weren't a particularly attractive couple physically. She was very tall with a rather angular face, and he was very tall also, but very roly-poly, like a series of circles on top of each other. And I don't know what it was, but I felt there was very little communication, and I felt the indication that the problems were, or the secondary problems were within the marriage, arose out of the fact that it was only when she was home and alone with him that she really crashed and her chin hit the ground, as it were. So I went back to the basic question which I begin with in this sort of thing. Do you care for each other? Yes, we do, etc., etc. And then, why did you look at that person twice? What was it that led you marrying that individual? And I will not accept the answer because I loved him or her. In other words, why did you look twice in that direction as opposed to that direction when first you met? And she knew exactly. And she gave me her answer straight out. She said, oh, I know. I knew of him. I knew why he was someone, I knew that he was someone I could utterly rely on. He was someone who would never go off womanizing. He was absolutely solid. Well, he was solid in many ways. And she didn't think much of herself. She was very impaired. She knew she didn't look very attractive and so on. And to have somebody who was interested in her, she thought, if that's the case, I know I can trust this man absolutely. And he, you know, smiled and smirked, and then I said, and you, why did you look at her twice? And he looked and absolutely dumbfounded that anyone should ask such a question, hadn't a clue, and her face just, you know, dropped as he, don't know. And then suddenly he went crimson, and you could see the red just creeping up his face like this. And he said, well, it was like this. I was at a party, and I looked round, and there was a nice pair of legs, and she was on top of them. And she glowed. She positively radiated pleasure. And her comment was, I always thought my legs were the only nice bit about me. Now, a silly question, with what you may think is a silly answer. But you know, that couple never looked back from that question. Because for the first time in 12 years, or 14 years, or whatever it was, of married life, he had given her a compliment which she could accept as being valid. For 12 years, she had longed to have something positive coming in her direction. And this was the first time he'd said something nice to her which she felt was utterly and absolutely genuine, which she could say, I know that that's true. And from then on, they began to communicate. And when you're dealing with these marriage problems, it really is sometimes a way of trying to get through to the beginnings of communication. This wasn't a bad marriage. This was a stable marriage. This is a couple who cared for each other. But they'd never been able to communicate at a level which gave the feeling of being cared for. And I think many marriages are in fact stunted at the level of actually saying things, you know, to each other. Having the time to say things to each other. Or the lack of embarrassment to say things to each other. Which the other person can say, yeah, that makes sense to me. There was only one thing she thought was nice about her. That was her graceful slim legs. And he'd actually noticed them. And that's what made her look twice at her. And he'd never said that to her in 12 years. Now, that didn't stop her depressions. She had mild depression. She was a person who was very vulnerable. But she never had to come into hospital again. She never had to come and see me for a major session. And as far as I'm aware, and I do get feedback from other sources from time to time, there's a couple who have gone on from strength to strength. Would be too much to say, but certainly bit by bit over the years. And so there's a fundamental question sometimes to begin with. Why that person? Now normally if I'm talking on this sort of thing as a topic in itself, I usually stop and say, I want the spouses to look at each other, or if your spouse is not here, think of your spouse. Don't say anything. And just ask yourself, why did I look twice in that direction? What was it about that person that made me decide to follow up the contact? And the point about it is it often gives a clue as to the expectations of the marriage, which may never have been expressed, and which may therefore never have been fulfilled. And that, of course, may be the beginnings of disaster. And, of course, I'll come to another example of that in a minute or two. Now, the second couple was a couple, again, who cared for each other, both professionals, both decided that children were something they didn't want. They felt that they couldn't cope, they had, you know, insufficient emotional resources to cope with themselves, a job, and children. And not an uncommon scenario in certain centres now. And she was something of a perfectionist. She was a teacher, drove herself at school, exceptionally good teacher. When she came home at night, she was absolutely exhausted, never felt she'd done a good enough job, and various factors led to her, because of changes in the educational structures and so on, led to her becoming quite depressed and very panicky and depressed. Again, one saw her. She didn't need an antidepressant. She just needed to have a bit of help to see how to handle the things which were at school, but she remained as a person who was extremely tense, and again, the issue came up that instead of being able to relax at home, she often felt more tense at home, and so on. I saw the husband, nice, laid-back sort of character, not as academic as she, but a nice, stable sort of character, and I suspected that he was the sort of chap that she chose, who she could sort of have her hysterics and her blow-offs and all the rest of it, and he would just watch her and say, "There, there, my dear, what was that all about?" And she'd be angry with him, but really very pleased that he didn't overreact to her. And in fact, that's actually what happened. And they understood that, and they got on right. But the resentment still remained. She still exploded with him from time to time, and he used to feel it a bit wearing after a while. And so what one had to try and do for them was that, how can we progress a step further in order to help this couple actually feel that they're caring for one another? So the expectations were there. They'd discussed those to some extent. They were communicating at that level. But how could they actually put this into practice? Because what would happen is, why don't you be a different sort of person in addition to being what you are? Or why don't you be a different sort of person in addition to being what you are? And so both of them were putting global expectations upon each other to be, you know, totally caring in whatever way it was that they wanted. And what emerged when I said, no, I won't have that, I want a specific which you can both do, practice, and score at the end of the week, which gives an indication that you really are trying. It's not why are you not different, but you know, why can't you do just this one thing which show you care? And what came out was that she felt when she came in, having done a day's work, having done the meal, could sit down and he would go off and make the coffee. Now, in any self-respecting French home, that's precisely what would happen. It's coffee making is far too serious a business to be left to women. But in the Anglo-Saxon world, you get this awful stuff they call coffee served to you, and it's women's work, that. Anyway, so what happened was, he said, but I'm tired when I come home. And she said, what do you think I am? So with a bit of a grunt and a mump, he said, all right, I'll make the coffee, I'll try anyway. And then I asked her what he would like from her. He said, what I'd like from her is when she goes off in the morning to a job, she turns around and gives me a peck on the cheek and said, you know, have a nice day. Because often she goes off in a bad temper as she faces the work, and I find that difficult. And her immediate reaction was, you know I'm not that stoppy type. Well, they both said they would try it. And when I saw them the next time, they came in giggles. said that they'd really had 100% success. There was one bad day, however. He'd done his coffee thing. But there was one bad day when they'd had a bit of a row. She stormed out the house, down the garden path, slammed the gate, into her car, slammed the door, and was just about to drive off when she thought, damn that Dr. Barker. Marched up the path, gave him a peck on the cheek and said, bear. And as she told the story, I mean, he was beaming all over his face. He knew what that had cost her. And she'd done it for him. And she knew that in her heart of hearts, she longed to be able to communicate something a bit more in terms of affection than she often did. And again, there's a couple, all right, the problems went over. But again, there was a movement. And out of those two stories, there are two things which come. Many of the marital problems which come. Many of the hope depressions and so on. Many of the moans and groans and so on can often be resolved by just trying to find some way in which the two can begin to communicate at the level of expectations, perhaps. And secondly, just something which can be repeated, something which is simple, something which can be scored, something which the other recognizes is for them but costs as well. And that's all that's sometimes needed to start things off. Now that can be done by anybody. You don't have to be a marriage guidance counsellor to do that. You don't have to be a psychiatrist to do that. When we had our 25th wedding anniversary, we went away for a week and it was actually a conference we were invited to, which coincided in time, for the missionaries and expatriates and so on from the French-speaking evangelical world. And the French Missionary Societies dragged their missionaries on furlough up to this conference and get somebody to come and speak to them. And this time it was an Anglo-Saxon psychiatrist. And most of them felt, what has an Anglo-Saxon psychiatrist got to speak, got to say to French missionaries? Well, anyway, I was tackling this subject, and we thought this was quite a good exercise, and I was doing a little bit of work on ourselves. And I said, look, we've been married for 25 years. I'm talking to them about the marriages. What about ours? Is there anything I could do that would make you feel that I was actually working at communicating even better? And likewise. And my wife had no doubts whatsoever about something which I could do. And that was, instead of getting into the car and opening her door from the inside, I open the door from the outside and then get into the car later. It doesn't cost much, really. But she knows it cost me an awful lot. But again, there's something which, yes, it is possible to change. Something which takes us a stage further. Something where we communicate to other, you really do matter. We're not taking each other for granted. What could she do for me? Work harder at getting the sort of in-tray into the out-tray a little bit more often in the domestic correspondence. Well, I bought her a word processor, which helped that enormously. And then lastly, a picture here of a clergy couple. They've been married for several years. She was a teacher. And after several years, she'd become quite depressed, agoraphobic. She couldn't go out of the home unless accompanied by friends or by him. And she'd come for special help at that level. And it was quite clear, as with most married agoraphobics, there is a domestic communication problem, by definition, almost 100%. And when I saw him and I said, look, why did you marry that person? What was it that drew you to her? Because there was no doubt that she felt very, very undervalued. And he said, well, I saw her at an open air, actually. She was obviously very good at speaking public. I knew she was a teacher subsequently. She was very involved with the church she was attached to. I found her sexually attractive. And she was obviously good with kids. And as he was saying this, her face just, you know, went lower and lower and lower and lower. And I paraphrase this, what you said is that she'd make a good Sunday school teacher, she'd be splendid with women's meetings, she'd actually be a good parish worker as well, a good concubine, and a good mother. You've told me nothing about her as a person. And she exploded, that's it, that's exactly what I feel. And his comment was, you're trying to destroy our marriage, and didn't come again. Now you're treading on very private and dangerous grounds. But it seems to me that many of the marital problems do go back to expectations and communication and the will to defer to the other person. There's a lovely translation, and I think it's the American Revised Catholic Version on Ephesians chapter 5, which says, defer to one another. Think of the other person first. And you know that bit that says, you know, husbands love your wives and so on, and wives obey your husbands. Husbands love your wives as Christ loved the church. That when there's a difference between you, who makes the shift? Who's the person that makes the first move when there's a deadlock in communication? In my experience, almost 100% the wife. But it was Christ who made the first move to us when we were estranged. That when we love, as Christ loved us, or love the church, maybe it's the husband who should be making the first move. Right, let's move on from marriage. And then I was asked about the career neurotic. Again, this is much more the male problem. I touched on it already. What makes life tick? I asked people, what are their goals in life? I mentioned the writer of Ecclesiastes. I also asked them what means they've used to achieve those goals, because the means which are used to achieve goals are the means which will have to be used to maintain those goals. So the overwork in order to get there will involve overwork in order to stay there. The overinvestment in saying, well, we can always catch up with the spiritual or something else or the marital and so on in due course, means you've written the script for the rest of the scenario as well. And I was taught most by actually an academic, a high-ranking academic, who came again profoundly depressed. He was clinically depressed, there was a family history, he responded to an antidepressant, and then we began to look at what was behind it. Because when he was at the depths of his depression, the thing that preoccupied him most was that he had sacrificed everything in his life in order to gain one particular post. And when this post was offered to him, he realized with sickening certainty he didn't want it. It would have meant so much change in his life that when he added it up, it wasn't worth it. And yet his whole life had been actually directed towards gaining this. And as we looked at him and looked at his life, here he was, a man from a fairly humble background in some ways, at least that's how he saw it, Christian man, able, not brilliant, happily married to a wife who had completely supported him. But eventually, here he was, jet-setting with them all throughout the world, never seeing his students, never seeing his wife. His kids were grown up. She had a job of her own, and having been offered what he had then considered to be the most prestigious job, he realized it was merely a shell and he had lost everything in trying to get to it. And at the end of it all, as he went off for a holiday with his wife and they just walked the hills which they knew, as he turned down the job which he'd been offered and decided to work a bit harder at his own area, so at the end of it all, too, he said, and what's more, I feel that I'm now much more committed as a Christian once more. And he said, you know, this has been the most therapeutic experience of my life. I never want to go through this again, but I can only say that it has rescued my family, our marital relationship, my own department, and my own soul. Less happy in some ways was a garage owner who again had done everything for his family, poured all his money into his job, made a lot of money. One day he turned home and his wife literally had packed his bag and put it on the doorstep and said, get lost. I don't want to know you. I haven't known you for some years and I feel that's the end of it. And he came utterly depressed and felt utterly betrayed as well. I've done everything for her and the children, and she's got the money, but she doesn't want me. And when one went over his life, he in fact had neglected his parents, he had fought with them and almost spat them out. His colleagues he had treated abominably over the years. He'd been ruthless in his financial arrangements, and his wife he just took for granted utterly. And when I exposed this and said to him, well, you're only reaping the investments which you've got, you invested in your work, you've got a tremendous amount of money invested in there, and it's doing very well, isn't it? You've invested nothing in your parental relationships, your marital relationships, your family relationships. You have no friends. You've got what you wanted, haven't you? And I didn't feel he needed an antidepressant. He went off very angry. He said, I didn't come to be lectured in that way. I said, no, I want you to think about that and come back next time and see me. And he came back and he said, you know, you will think I am absolutely bonkers. What's happened is I've gone and become a Christian since I saw you. Now, he didn't know I was Christian. But he'd had one friend at work who had consistently witnessed to him over the years. And for the first time in his life, he was prepared to listen to this very faithful and Christian friend. Well, and there's no happy ending to that one. His wife didn't want to know him again and so on. But there was a new direction, a very immature Christian in many ways for some years, but at least things had turned. It's often been said by a vicar that I know very well that it takes a little bit of adultery, unfaithfulness and financial ruin to make people look at the gospel. And there's some truth in that. What makes life tick? Where are one's goals? And that's a question which sometimes needs to be asked, and sometimes to be asked quite ruthlessly, but at the same time prepared to then take the person through the implications of that. And I would suggest that you as pastors are much, much more able to take that on than I. You really can pursue that. Let's go on to bereavement. We've talked a little bit about this and beforehand. But you will deal with an enormous number of bereaved people. And many bereaved people do actually become profoundly depressed and may need an antidepressant even though they're going through a bereavement. It is classical for them to have physical symptoms. It's classical for them to have disturbed sleep. It's classical for them to feel fatigued, to go off their food, and so on. Facing the day is awful. So the overlap between a bereavement reaction and a depression is very considerable. And it sometimes is very difficult to know when to give someone an antidepressant to proceed to clinical methods of treating, as opposed to merely saying bereavement is something you work through. But again, the features which I outlined to you earlier on, I think, still stand. When that person is getting to a situation where everything is included in a morbid, from a morbid perspective, where the person is suicidal, where the person's life is beginning to collapse, where previously they'd coped, then I think an antidepressant is warranted. And what you may find is that some people cannot begin to grieve properly because the depression is not being treated. Many people say, I cannot cry, there are no more tears to cry. And then when you put them on an antidepressant, the tears begin to flow and the bereavement process, which is also a healing process, begins to start and tick over. So some prolonged bereavement reactions are because the person has become depressed, because sometimes they've been depressed before, because there is a family history of depression and so on. So never lose sight of the fact that even the person who is bereaved, who has many of the symptoms which look like just ordinary bereavement, may actually be sufficient enough to merit a clinical diagnosis of depression. The two must then be dealt with hand in hand. An antidepressant does not stop a person grieving. It may enable the person to grieve who is caught in the grip of a depression. On the other hand, a tranquilizer, such as Valium and Ativan and things like that, that may give relief in the same way as alcohol gives relief, but certainly doesn't aid the bereavement process. But I think of some of the people who were bereaved and the way in which their bereavement was not actually recognized by other people, sometimes rejected by other Christians. Two of the most famous cases I know here are C.S. Lewis and another famous writer. I may have actually spoken to some of you about this before. Do you remember how C.S. Lewis, in the midst of his depression, expressed the anger and the resentment and so on? Meanwhile, where is God? This is one of the most disquieting symptoms. When you are happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing him, so happy that you are tempted to feel his claims upon you as an interruption, if you remember yourself and then turn to him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it seems, welcome with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face, and a sound of bolting, and double bolting on the inside, and after that silence, you may as well turn away. The longer you wait, the more emphatic the silence will become. It might be an empty house. Was it ever inhabited? It seemed so once. And that seeming was as real as this. What can you mean? He's so present, a commander in our time of prosperity. But now, but the next day he wrote, I wrote that last night. It was a yell rather than a statement. Let me try it over again. Is it rational to believe in a bad God? Anyway, in a God so bad as all that? The cosmic sadist? The spiteful imbecile? C.S. Lewis. He wrote it under the pseudonym of Clark. And I think some people, when they first realized it was C.S. Lewis wrote that, felt how awful that that great defender of the Christian faith could write that in his bereavement. But here was a man, as he says in his books, who was given a taste of marriage and of companionship and of bliss, as it were, totally unexpected in the latter end of his late middle life. For God then come and take it away again, having given him a taste. It was snitched. And how could he not say to God, how could you do this to me? Wouldn't I have been better off without this? But he had to work through that. And many Christians who in fact become locked into the unresolved bereavement are Christians who are unable to look at that part of the bereavement reaction, which is the questioning, which may be the anger, which may be the explosion, if only to say, there it is. Now, just a minute, let's pull that back, because that's not the last statement. The other example which I use is the example of the lady who wrote Through Gates of Splendor. And many of you will remember Through Gates of Splendor as that triumphant account of these missionaries to Iuka, the Iuka Indians, who were then speared just as they made their first contact with those Indians. And she wrote Through Gates of Splendor, and there's a magnificent hymn that went with it, and people thought what a marvelous description of Christians triumphing in the midst of so-called tragedy. And then she wrote another book later, and this little book was called No Graven Image. And No Graven Image was a novel of a South American missionary who, in fact, was the result, who caused the death of the prize convert by giving him penicillin to which he was allergic. And she wrote, these four walls, they're still here, my home, my quiet place to come back to after visiting the Indians. They can't reach me here. Nobody can reach me here, but God can. Where is the refuge from him? I was going to sacrifice this home for him. What of the sacrifices I've already made? Did you toy with them, O ineffable, sardonic God, who toys with our sacrifices and smashes to earth the humble, hopeful altars we have built for a place to put your name? Do you mock me? Why did you let him die? Why did you let me kill him? Oh God, I came to bring him life, your life, and I destroyed him in your name. A donkey clopped by on the road outside, and I could hear the sound of a whip and an Indian voice. There was silence. I looked at the Bible on the table in front of me and started to pick it up. My hand dropped again. I could not find answers there anymore. Nothing had worked for me as I thought it would work. God had nothing to say to me now. Where was he anyway? Elizabeth Elliot, who married again and lost that husband. But when she wrote that book, the Christian world said, she has lost her faith, and it was remaindered for 10p in the Christian bookshops. And it was 20 years before it was republished as a paperback. But I would say that that was an essential part of the grieving process. She had to be able to express that as part of the triumph. Do you remember the words of Paul in 1 Thessalonians? We grieve, but not as those without hope. But we do grieve. And many Christians talk of the hope and the glory and the departed one is with the Lord Jesus. And there sitting in the front row, I am quoting of an exact example. And there in the front row was the widow and the daughter breaking their hearts as this man cut off in the prime of his life, the height of his usefulness, was being buried, about to be buried. We grieve. It's essential we grieve. And that kind of questioning is essential as part of it. But not as those without hope. And I would again have to say that when I have to deal with bereavement reactions which have gone wrong, there are two things which come up again and again. One, that the complications in the relationship of a couple, for instance, are repeated in the grieving process of the one who is left. So the over-dependency in life is repeated in the enormous dependency of the bereaved person subsequently. The clandestine relationship in life has to be a clandestine bereavement reaction. The relationship which was given as a special token of God's love in late middle life then was associated with an explosion of, wow, do you now take it from me? The relationship which was utterly committed as they saw under God to go to the Iuka Indians, and then it had to be dealt with. But that wasn't what God had for you. He had other ways, perhaps, of dealing with that. The expectations of the relationship, the problems, even the nice things of the relationship, will be then recapitulated in the bereavement process. And the inability to see that, the inability to see the complications of the relationship and how that affects the bereavement, is one of the problems I meet. And the second thing is this inability to cope with the anger and the aggression which is there. And that is particularly so in Christians, but not exclusive to them. Right, let me move on to the situation of the inadequate and the obsessional. Now, here I put these two together, and I don't mean that all obsessionals are inadequate or that all inadequates are obsessional. But there is a personality type or types which do require common handling. The personality problem which demands that we meet their unfulfilled emotional needs. You see, I talked about the perfectionist earlier. The person who is perhaps overcautious, who is all or nothing. A person who often feels very guilty. They just feel guilty anyway. So anything of a certain kind of preaching and so on, they will take to themselves and feel even guiltier. And then hold you responsible because you're the one that preached like that. And therefore it's your responsibility to minister to them in that context. And many of these people feel attracted to the Christian fellowship, because Christians are nice, warm, accepting people. And especially if you're conversion fodder, you know, they're even warmer to you. When they get converted, hallelujah! But when they still bring with them into their Christian life this immature personality, overcautious, uncertain, looking for reaffirming the whole time. It's not the doctrine of assurance that they need. It is constant reassurance which they need. Then what happens? Christians become a bit cooler. Christians say, well, you haven't got the doctrine right. And they feel rejected. And they begin to demand more. And I think of one lady in this context who in fact said at one small group, she said, you know, I can count on the fingers of two hands the people I can really confide in. And somebody else in the group said, you're lucky. I can only think of two or three people that I can really confide in. She wasn't amused. Because what happens with these people is they're so often trying to replace parental figures who have not given them enough affection, or they feel they've not given them enough affection, with new parental figures. And the pastor, the counselor, the psychiatrist, the doctor, anyone who is prepared to listen, will be pressed into service, and as many as possible, the better. It's just possible that one of these figures will become the perfect husband, father, mother, substitute, whatever it is. But no one can ever replace the person that they long for. They may have had problems in their lives. They may have had certain damage. But you cannot be to them what they have lost. And what I would say with such people is one needs to set the limits. And I would begin by saying, first of all, the facts of your life you have to come to terms with. Facts are facts. You make them more difficult by making them problems. I'm indebted to Alec Mateer for that particular one, who said, "Monty, we were brought up in the days when facts were still facts and hadn't yet become problems." And there's a truth in that. Remember Joni? Broken neck. The first book is all about seeking healing for a broken neck. No healing coming. So, okay, the fact is I've got a broken neck. Now, where do we go from here? And in the second book, she begins to explore how she began to be used as a person with a broken neck. And then the third book, a step further, etc. And I would say, no, while you make the facts of your life problems, the fact that somebody was abused, rejected, and so on, while those are the problems, you can't take them away, they're there. You say, given that, where do we go from here? And then the person begins to make progress. They begin to reorder the way they think of things. Instead of saying the bottle is half empty, they say, well, the bottle's actually half full. And so they appraise their situation. They need to be taken in small doses. You can't, in fact, give them all they want, so you need to dilute them. You need to have lots of people giving little bits rather than one or two people giving an enormous amount. And in that context, they can get lots of little parental things from lots of people at a level which can be maintained, sustained, and go on. Now, I recall a clergyman here, teacher, someone who, very difficult relationship with father, someone who never felt he was good enough, although extremely able scholar, got his A-levels, got to one of the top universities that he wanted to go to, and then became a Christian. And father was absolutely appalled at his throwing away his life in this sort of way. But his conversion experience was very real, and for the first time he felt, yes, he was loved. He was loved of Christ and of God. And the chronic tension which he began to feel in his O-levels, A-levels, began to disappear, and he thought, yes, this is it. Life is going to be different. And then up came his finals, and he began to have tension again. And then he had the experience of filling of the Holy Spirit, which was then the sort of fashionable thing in the 50s. And this gave him a real sense of being filled of the Spirit, and again, a diminution of his anxiety. And then he went out to teach, and he was in a very difficult situation at one point academically. And some people came along and said what he needed was the baptism of the Spirit. And this was the 60s now. And the baptism of the Spirit was then talked about, and he had a baptism of the Spirit and had the signs of the baptism of the Spirit, which were acceptable, and again a diminution of his anxiety. Then he went to theological college, and things were a bit difficult. He began to get depressed and tense again, but there wasn't any other experience at that time to replace the baptism. They hadn't had slaying and all the other things. Now, all right, you laugh, but these are very important things to some people, and you can see how these things can be pressed into service in this sort of way. And such people are prone to look for some magic formula. And the more that one offers the formula, whatever formula it is, the more these people will say, yes, this is it, and then be disappointed. And in fact, he became depressed. I said he needed to have an antidepressant. He wasn't going to have an antidepressant. The Lord would heal him, and off he went to a healing center, and they laid hands on him. And he threw away the tablets into the fire and became profoundly depressed and came back and said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to do nothing because you don't want my help. You're an Arminian. He was actually very reformed. I said, you're an Arminian, you're going to do it all in your own strength. And there's a little bit of you theologically as an Arminian as well, because you're seeking salvation by feelings of reassurance. And I suppose that was an insult, and a fellow psychiatrist who heard what I did there said, do you normally insult your patients this way? But he stomped out and came back and said, you're right, well, yin. And having set the limit, but having also at the same time given promise of support, he began his antidepressants. He began then to begin with the facts of his life. He began then to say, yes, I'm never perhaps going to be free of anxiety for one reason or another, but I'll have to learn to live within the confines of that. And to this day, he's actually having a very effective ministry. And when I last saw him, he said, yes, I occasionally get my collywobbles in my stomach. And here is my thorn in the flesh. And with a grin, he said, yes, and I'm still a charismatic, by the way. A reformed charismatic. They need to have limits, be in small doses, and in that context, learn. But they need to be handled consistently. All right, let's move on, lastly, to the mentally ill. And may I say that for the manic depressive, the person who has severe ups and downs of mood, the prognosis actually is very good, despite my GP friend over here wondering whether, in fact, that was so. For many manic depressives, that's people who have abnormal elation as well as abnormal depression, lithium carbonate, which is a simple salt, actually does a fantastic job in a large proportion of cases. And I have one or two patients who've been on it for many years, and when they stop it, they're into hospital, and they try that once or twice just to show, look, no hands, and then they fall on their faces and come back in on the medicine, and then do very well. One, not so long ago, got decorated by the Queen for services to his particular profession and so on. And he says, actually, this is your medal, doctor, not mine. Yeah, I wouldn't have minded it, but people don't want to acknowledge their shrinks in public too often. But the point I want to make here is that actually it does have a better prognosis. And these people require not lots and lots of counselling. These people need folks to still be with them as they go through the pain and the anguish, as they say the most dreadful things, which afterwards, when they become well, having been up in the, you know, up top and really blasting off. You know the phrase, in vino veritas, in wine there is truth. Well, some people in mania, when they're rather hypermanic, may also tell people exactly what they think of them in a none too diplomatic way. And then they've got to come to terms with what they've actually said to people afterwards. It can be incredibly embarrassing. And they're utterly ashamed. And the Christians, you can stay alongside such people. Or the people who have actually told about themselves and things about themselves when they're utterly depressed, which they had never done, to understand that this was an illness and that they must be just stayed with patiently. That can be far more healing than any other kind of counselling. I remember one missionary who had a very deep depression in midlife, and she said that it wasn't the Christian psychiatrist who was most helped to her. She had one. Nor was it her Christian friends. They were very nice. But it was her pagan Christian colleague who didn't know anything about her illness, who responded to her just as an ordinary person, who did most to give her back a sense of dignity, a sense of being a human being again. And now, as a second career, immensely used of God in that. And sometimes we want to move in with such people with all sorts of spiritual advice. And the spiritual advice may be, no, you can give up reading the Bible. You can give up praying. Maybe you come to church, but even there you may feel that you cannot. And this particular missionary I was talking about, the only thing that really helped her, she said, was actually going to a high Anglican church where she was sure of getting communion once a week. Nobody else had communion once a week in the particular context that she was in, but this particular Anglican, I think the Scottish Episcopalian vicar allowed her to take communion when it was against all his own church's canons because he saw her need. And she said the tangible and visible tokens of bread and wine were the only thing that gave her comfort in those very severe months and actually a year or two of depression. So the prognosis is good, but we must be careful that we don't move in and do more damage. Think of William Cowper, again, severe manic depressive. It was the attention which was consistent and kept up by Newton, which was excellent. And I don't agree with the people who said that Newton was responsible for William Cowper's illness. It's not true. William Cowper was ill with a manic depressive illness long before he met Newton. Newton was the only person who showed any consistency of friendship, as Cowper went through his dips and then also had his highs as well. And the other thing, remember Elijah. We've talked already of Elijah. What did God do with Elijah when he had his depression? Elijah, there's some food and there's some sleep, some food and sleep and some rest. And then he said, now Elijah, we need to go to Mount Sinai to have some psychotherapy, just to get one or two things sorted out. And Nebuchadnezzar, poor old Nebuchadnezzar, there he was, really going off his rocker. He was grandiose, this great statue, everybody had to bow down. And then he began not to sleep, and he had these awful dreams, and came down from the state of hypomania and grandiosity into a situation where he shambled around the fields like an ox and so on. And then he came to his senses. No special psychotherapy then. Once he was better, now Nebuchadnezzar. Schizophrenia. And here I would say again, many schizophrenics have grave difficulty in relating intensely to anyone. And sometimes we move in far too intensely. What we need to do is stand back a bit. Allow a much cooler approach. Don't demand of yourself that you've got to make meaningful relationships with these people. These people need to be accepted, but at a low-key level, perhaps diluted, and just people sort of noticing them, saying hello to them, at a very simple, casual level, maybe much more reassuring to them than intense friendships, where they may have a feeling that far more is being expected of them than they can really fulfill. In our own church, we have quite a number of chronic schizophrenics, some of whom I've treated. I don't stop in the psychotherapeutic sessions with them, but I do acknowledge them. I say hello. I don't ask them how they are. That's not the context where I ask them how they are. That's the clinic's context. And they sometimes, when I meet them at the clinic, say, oh, I saw you in church. I said, yes, it was a good sermon or whatever. Sometimes they don't bother to comment. But I keep the areas a little bit separate. Within the church, we can actually be sometimes too intrusive, too demanding, too pressuring, creating an expectation of far more being possible than is really the case. Whereas to be accepted at a much simpler level, at a much more low-key level, may be much more appropriate. But we are busybodies sometimes when we're in the caring business. I'm going to stop there and give you a chance for questions. Take, you know, them just as they come, or... Where's the questioner? No, I don't habitually pray with my patients. I do sometimes with a very occasional patient. But if I prayed with my patients, there is a sense in which that means a level of commitment to them beyond the clinical context. Now I've got to be sure that I can really maintain that. There's an expectation built into that. So I don't habitually pray with my Christian patients, and I certainly don't pray with my non-Christian patients. I wouldn't say I never do, because I do sometimes. But I have to be very careful that I don't put in an expectation which I'm not able to maintain. You know, in other words, I see them for half an hour, 1 hour, and then say, see you next month. In fact, when a patient approached me once in church and said she wanted to discuss things with me, I said, no, that's Tuesday's business, not Sunday's. She was absolutely appalled. Saw her on Tuesday, I had to take her into hospital against her will. And she said afterwards, actually, the most helpful thing I did with her was when I refused to speak to her about her state on the Sunday. She said it made her realize that she hadn't really worked out what the Christian faith was about, and she was using church as a way of getting extra access to me. She became a Christian and came to tell me 5 years later.
You mentioned about bereavement that we grieve, but not like those who have no hope. This made me think of a report, a very brief report in the papers a few weeks ago of a psychiatrist who had said that people who are depressed are actually seeing the world as it is.
Yes, I saw that.
Which was a very, very abbreviated statement, but I just wonder, is there an element in that where people are brought face to face with the possibility of a universe with no meaning and can't take it and can't progress to the spiritual answer?
Do you want me to answer that one? Yeah, I suppose. I'd agree with that. It was a very truncated report, and the way it was processed indicated that only depressed people see the world as it really is. What a depression does sometimes is forces the person to see the world as they really view it, which can sometimes be utterly bleak and so on. And for them, yes, that's all it is. So I would agree with that, and I do use that. Do you want to comment on that?
No, but I've got nothing more to say.
Yes, you haven't spoken to, or maybe you've mentioned it once or twice in the past, a concept of divine intervention within psychiatric problems. I don't know exactly, but I'm tempted to think that someone like John White, who wrote The Masks of Melancholy, has become involved in a fellowship like that in the States, and I wonder if you've had any thoughts along those lines.
No, I haven't, because I wasn't asked to. If you want my thoughts on that in fuller, then you'll have to ask me again, won't you? but may I say, John White... There are two angles to John White. One is his book, Masks of Melancholy, is extraordinarily organically orientated. Which is extraordinary, really. Almost as though he had to sort of justify why he took that. And I think a person who takes such an extreme position in one book almost has to redress the balance in another book. And I do wonder whether Johnny White hasn't gone too hard in one direction and then has sort of gone too far the other direction. Because many Christians find his book is fine, The Master Melancholy, but it's inadequate. Whereas we would find his other book more recently... problematical in that he does seem to be less than objective about some of the issues. So that's one thing about Johnny White. The second thing is, I always worry, and this is a very personal thing now about John White, I always worry why someone who the moment he retires takes this position, but when he was in the medical establishment didn't actually take the position which he now does. He gave up his psychiatric practice and then goes off to Wimber. That again poses a problem for me. Why the sudden dramatic change? Almost as though there was one bit he couldn't look at when he was earning his money from the health service. Now, I don't know whether that's kind or fair, but it does worry me. So, divine intervention, I cannot see why God should intervene more in mental illness than in other illness, nor less in mental illness than other illness. I have no... problems with God intervening in his own way, with whomsoever he wishes, in whatsoever conditions he wishes. What I do dislike is when people then begin to say, and this is it, and this is the way you get it, and this is the context in which it comes. And there is a danger, it seems to me, in the Wimber movement along those lines. And Johnny White does nothing to dispel my anxiety there.
One more question.
You were speaking of some of the problems which originate in childhood. Is there any way in the Christian nurture of our children that we can prepare them and defend them against depression when they grow up?
Prevention and recession. I'll have a go after you. Right?
Yes. I mean, there's no question in our mind after what we've been involved in over the last 6 years, which is considerably less than Dr. Barker's experience, but The sort of parenting that goes on, the sort of relationships that go on, are quite fundamental and crucial to the way that people turn out and to their vulnerabilities and what they're able to offer later on. As far as your question is, you know, is there anything that we can actually do in our as parents, something along that line? And all I can say is that we have, as parents, we have a responsibility to be warm, affectionate, giving, to provide a firm structure for our relationships with our children. None of us are perfect, and if we make some kind of attempt to operate within that kind of context, then I think that gives us that gives our children what they are needing as far as the future is concerned. That's not going to provide a sort of, that's no guarantee against emerging problems later on, because as Dr. Barker has already pointed out, there are a significant number of people who, by virtue of their own innate genetic makeup and chemical makeup, are going to end up with mental health problems in later life, and no matter how good the parenting is in childhood, it's not going to necessarily modify that susceptibility.
I was once asked to give a talk in church, and I was offered various topics, and one of them was teenage rebellion. And I said, well, I'll have to check this out with the kids first as to whether I can talk on this subject in public. And they said, yes, rather that than the other topics which were given. I said, well, if that's the case, now you'll have to help me. And when it came to actually preparing the talk, I sat down. I'm allowed to tell the story. I'm given permission by the children to do so. That, and the daughter said, Dad, you wouldn't recognize Teenage Rebellion if you saw it. And that was it. And you have never met it anyway. And sort of marched out. You see, and that was it. And, and the lad said, well, look, Dad, it's like this. First of all, we feel grown up. He was 14. We feel grown up, and you've got to enable us to feel that too. Secondly, we don't yet have the experience, and we need to know how far to go. So even if we do, you know, fuss a bit, we do need to know where the limits are. And thirdly, that no great sessions. No heavy sessions. I thought those were the three points. I have another one, that when things really do break down, then what Johnny White actually has written a superb book on, Parents in Pain. But as I thought about that, I thought that's it, isn't it? That, first of all, you keep abreast with your kids, because sometimes they outstrip you in how far they've gone. And I think of Jesus with his parents. They had realized that he was ready for his bar mitzvah. They expected him to be playing with other kids. But he was in the temple where they should have expected him. Mother, didn't you know I had to be about my father's business? Cheeky answer, not at all. They hadn't realized he's about to do his bar mitzvah. And sometimes we get it wrong. Secondly, discipline. That they should know where we stand and why we do that. And we may be wrong, but we should be able to have the lines of communication open where we can actually say, look, that is why we say that. This is what we say. And then, thirdly, no heavy sessions. I think sometimes we can grind our kids' noses in it and so on. And some parents, and I think some evangelical parents, not just them, can sometimes, you know, rub their kids' noses in something which goes wrong. Instead of saying, there it is, you know it's wrong. They know it's wrong. And we don't have to go on about it. God doesn't go on with us in that sort of way if we acknowledge it. And Mary, you remember, store up all these things in her heart. So, yep, be abreast of them, have the line of communication open where they know what we think, and not too many kids do know where we are and why. And thirdly, don't go on.
Thank you very much. I would like to say thank you to Dr. Jones and Dr. Barker for their help today. I'm sure there are many other questions you would like to ask, and you can ask them after the session is over. In a few moments, or in a second, Ian Wright is coming to speak to us just a few things about care, and then I'd like if we could sing the hymn 436 if the Reverend Philip can find an appropriate tune in our book. But whilst we're waiting for that and the benediction, could we ask Ian to come and say the concluding words?